Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the African experience. The new head of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council, Cardinal Peter Turkson, shares insights about his work in his native Ghana. And Australia's first saint, the postulator for the cause of canonization of Mary MacKillop, talks about the life and legacy of this pioneering sister. Head of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council, Cardinal Peter Turkson, says he will use his wide experience of justice and peace work in West Africa to help shape the agenda in his new job here in the Vatican. Just a few weeks after arriving to take up his new position, the former Archbishop of Cape Coast in Ghana is expected to have an audience with Pope Benedict over the coming days to discuss priorities for his council. In the meantime, the Cardinal told me, he's working on ways of applying the most recent papal encyclical Caritas in Veritate to specific areas of justice and peace work at the local level. I sat down with the Cardinal to talk about his experiences and the insights he brings with him from his home country.
We, the Bishops' Conference of Ghana, had a Justice and Peace Commission. And every diocese had that. We had a pretty vibrant Justice and Peace Commission in the Archdiocese of Cape Coast. And the latest thing we're taking out was, the thing about the education. And it's basically, to ensure that Catholic education was left solid, to try to get a government to kind of respect, the church's right to run schools and have everything. Because we're in this in a very big way in Ghana, as probably in several other African countries where the church has always been the pace setter in a whole lot of this, education, healthcare, and all of that. In Ghana, for example, in several communities, it's always the church who takes the lead on account of our work, getting to all kinds of areas. And we get to places where, long before the government, gets over there. And so we do have a lot of schools in several places. And if you were to take Cape Coast, which is now a metropolitan, a metropolis, as it were, and all of that, if you wanted to count how many state-owned schools or state schools started by the government in Cape Coast, you probably not be able to count any. Because Cape Coast is a big town for the missionaries, okay? And it used to be the seat of the colonial government, the British. And that was a point of call of several missionary groups. So the schools in Cape Coast are either Methodist, Anglican, Catholic, or Zionist, and stuff like that. And if you're looking for a school which is just a local council or district assembly or whatever, hardly any in Cape Coast itself. And that's pretty much the case in several other places. So that's what our Justice and Peace group was very much interested in, pushing, at least for this, past 2 years, pushing education, safeguarding the right of the church to own and run schools and to form people according to certain moral guidance and things like that. As I said, I wasn't the chairman of the Justice and Peace Commission, but being the Archbishop of Cape Coast, I had to work with this and follow this very closely. Additionally, I was involved a little bit also with this on the level of West African Bishops' Conference. Hitherto, there's been a French group and English group. Since 2007, we've tried to come together to form a single, Episcopal Conference, and I was the president of that. So there, too, we had very vibrant, Justice and Peace Commission getting into all kinds of issues. The last we were looking at seriously was also mining, issue of mining and environmental degradation, what, surface mining is now threatening to do to probably not only Ghana, but several other, countries where a mining company just think that it's cost-effective to do surface mining than to do shaft and go down and all of that. But as a result, They leave a land surface that you can hardly do anything else with. So we're also trying to bring that to the attention of the government and, you know, encourage the government to kind of still encourage them to do shaft mining and leave the surface for the local population to live on, to feed on, to work on. So we're doing a little bit of that, but I haven't been asked to be the relator in general at the Synod, whose team was also basically a little bit about this. And from there, I'm appointed to this position. So this has been my walk or my itinerary towards this, what I have to do now.
You'll be bringing, as you say, these very real-life experiences. You're talking about the work with the mining and the government's perspective on that. You'll be bringing a very African perspective to this work here, won't you, despite the fact that you're dealing with justice and peace for the Universal Church.
Definitely. And some of these issues are, you know, trans-African. Issue of mining is also lively in Brazil. It's also lively in several other places. The deforestation issue, which is related to surface mining, is true also in Brazil and several other, you know, tropical countries. So the big issues about the ultimate environmental degradation, which is now also probably a world issue on account of the global warming and climate change issues. So all of this feed into that.
Can we say this will be a priority, perhaps, at the Council or not?
It's still, I mean, it's a burning issue now in the world. The last summit here in Copenhagen was about that. The Holy Father's, New Year Peace Message was had to do with that. Even ever, Caritas in Veritate also, touched about. So it's just that thing of the, I suppose, it's humanity recognizing that we can have our cake and eat it. We cannot do, whatever we want to the environment and still expect it to protect us and safeguard our life and take care of our lives. So this has become the burning issue, but I still will hesitate to call it my priority because, as I said, I'd wish that the Pope set a tone rather than me setting it. And that does not also mean that until I have a chance to meet the Pope, we do nothing. It doesn't also mean that. Presently, for example, there's a plan to help disseminate, the encyclical with English-speaking and French-speaking African countries. There's one big thing planned here in Rome in June with the Vicariate of Rome with the Lateran University. There's another one planned with another group from the United States and the West Coast of the United States. So all of these activities are, but over and above this, I think here in the office itself, I wish to see whether the different officials, some follow issues, others follow continents. And we see whether we ourselves cannot even take the encyclical and then kind of relate that with the particular type of thing we do so that the one in charge of human rights can see, the issue of human rights and this encyclical. The one on environment and ecology can see, it's at this encyclical. And so we take very many teams and see, and so probably from that we can provide small little study pamphlets that can help people intensify their study of the Synod. And that's what we want to do.
You were mentioning in the context of your own country, Ghana, about working with other Christian churches. You were also very involved with Christian-Muslim dialogue, weren't you? What you call this dialogue of life, working on justice and peace issues. Is that also a priority, do you think?
Look, I'd be reading some other things about me from somewhere. So I used to be on the Catholic Methodist dialogue for some, and then Cardinal Lustiger also has started an initiative about meeting some Orthodox Jews in New York every year. I joined that group too, and then with Muslims in West Africa, and then particularly in Ghana. Then even on the level of a group called what we call the World Conference of Religions for Peace. So we're pretty much involved with all of those. But the one thing on the line it is all is that we don't get in there, first and foremost, talking theology, seeking to convince others about faith positions and all of that, because that's the one thing that you cannot even easily do. But probably certain general concerns can be addressed, and that's basically the big thing is the business of life. That's something that interests all of us. So in Ghana, that's also the form that very many ordinary people also get to appreciate the doing of dialogue. The fact that several communities, as you probably know, the way we were evangelizing Ghana, for example, was that the type of Christian faith we have followed which colonial power was in charge in Ghana. When the Portuguese came, the locality was Catholic. When the Dutch came, it became Calvinist Reformed Church type of thing. When the English came, it became Methodist and Anglican. And so it was. So people in Ghana are Methodist, Anglican, Catholic for reasons that have nothing practical to do with the Reformation. Therefore, in a household, you're bound to find, you know, people of the different faiths in the household, including even Islam. That being the case, we've always had to live together, not making religion divide us. And so the thing about being this or being that and being that, it's not being the basic determinant of our relationship. We live together because we're either members of the same family, although we profess different faiths. We're members of the same community, facing the same community life issues, although we belong to different faiths. And so traditionally we've lived the different religions and faiths, but still know how to come together to face certain common issues, about life, about health, about water provision, about food security, and things like that. You know, it's only lately that certain versions of all of this are coming up, which are straining the otherwise, you know, cordial relations that's always existed among very many of these people. A new brand of Islam is coming, which seems to be telling the traditional Muslims or the way they've been living that, you know, it's this not pure Islam, you know, and that you need to purify it. And purify it tends to also introduce a certain amount, you know, make it a little bit less tolerant and things like that. All of this is new.
Which is a huge challenge, though, for the church.
It is. It is also on the Christian side in the form of some strains of evangelical, you know, Christian whatever thing, which is also tending to make people develop more exclusivistic, you know, type of tendencies. So all of this, there are new challenges coming to all of this relationship, which, as I say, have hitherto been very cordial among us. So the challenges are coming, and we do not want to reciprocate, you know, pay people back, you know, their own coin. I mean, we don't give up wanting to collaborate and work with Muslims together on community issues because a new strain or a new tendency is emerging that tends to encourage them to be less tolerant. For that matter, we're not less open towards, you know, other Christians because of evangelicalism, which criticizes the Catholic Church and sees, you know, a lot of wrongs in the Catholic Church. I mean, at the end of the day, it's the basic life issues here on earth which will lead us to the other life beyond.
It's a worrying development, though, isn't it? I mean, how do you combat this fundamentalism, as you're saying, on both sides?
Yeah, I mean, it's a worrying development, but again, we realize that, you know, this is not a development that is unique and restricted to Africa. What has happened to us in Africa is an offshoot of what, if you want, is happening all over the world. So at a certain point, we take consolation in the fact that certain world developments have led to these strains of, you know, religious fundamentalism in all regard, Islam, whatever type of thing. We recognize that. So the cause of all of this new tendency we recognize go beyond us, go beyond our power. We cannot deal with the causes, but we can try to still make, let's say, Muslims or some of these evangelicals still recognize that for us it's the same. Encourage them to also try to, you know, Islam is Islam. But there can be ways that Arabs live Islam, and there can be ways that Africans also live Islam. And that's what we encourage them to do, to look at, you know, how would Africans taking the Quran live Islam? Can it be different from what Arabs do on account of their particular historical experiences? I mean, we're not involved in any Arab-Palestinian this conflict and this and that conflict. So if in that situation Islam is taking a particular form and strain, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same in Ghana. It's difficult because, you know, Islam doesn't have a central authority like we do in the Catholic Church. So you don't have one who can speak for all and whose position becomes the one that can be quoted as the official Islamic position. That's the difficulty we need to deal with. Same thing with the evangelicals. So these are some challenges we need to deal with. We recognize that, and we encourage them also to recognize this. And in their recognition, perhaps we'll still be able to carry on as we did or we've always done.
Is there any risk in Ghana or in that area of West Africa of the same thing we've seen in Nigeria recently?
You know, the risk is always there. Because if you want, of the nature of this religion, Islam is as religious as it's political. And so that being the case, ideally, I suppose for Muslims, the best situation would be Muslims must live under Islamic government or Islamic, you know, political authority. For some, Muslims living under a political government or which is not Islamic is probably not the most, you know, the desirable thing for them. So anything that can be done to rectify the situation, I suppose they would do. And that is basically the crux of the matter. We're just praying and hoping that probably by divine providence, since the emergence of Islam was 600 years before the Christian movement, we're hoping that if they also make some historical experience, they may also come to a point of recognizing that this thing cannot be upheld. But for the moment, I think that is the feeling. That is the feeling. And if any political situation can be modified so that Muslims are ruled by Muslims, which therefore caused some of this conflict and all, now that's the thing. But recognizing, however, that no single nation in Africa, even in North Africa, that they don't have a population which is all completely Islam, then probably that sense of therefore accommodating the interests and beliefs of those who are not whatever, just in the name of human rights and religious freedom and all of that. So we're just hoping that this type of thing will be understood. So these tensions and these difficult situations are there. And the thing in Nigeria sometimes reflects this. Because there's a rival claim about predominance. Christians claiming they're more, Muslims claiming they're more. So it's a fight a little bit about who is in charge here. Mm-hmm. In Ghana, we've not gotten to that yet. Because to a large extent, according to our last census, which was also disputed by the Muslims, Christians should be 65% and Muslims be 18%. They dispute that. They think they're more than that. But still, we're hoping that the cordial relationship that has been maintained up till now can inspire future conduct and the future ways that we continue to relate to each other.
My thanks there to Cardinal Peter Turkson from Ghana, the new head of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council. On Friday, Pope Benedict is due to preside at an ordinary public consistory here in the Vatican to announce the canonization of 6 men and women, including an Australian sister who is poised to become the nation's first saint. Blessed Mary MacKillop was born in 1842 in Melbourne after her family emigrated to Australia from Scotland. The eldest of 8 children, Mary went on to found the Sisters of St. Joseph, or Brown Joeys as they're affectionately known, dedicated to working with the poorest and most marginalised families. Throughout her life, Mother Mary had to cope with opposition from those opposed to her pioneering work. In 1871, she was briefly excommunicated by the local bishop for her unswerving commitment to a life of poverty and simplicity, living not in a monastery but in the outback alongside the people her sisters were serving. She died in August 1909 in the convent in North Sydney where her tomb is located. In 1995, Pope John Paul II presided at her beatification during his visit to the city, and in July 2008, Pope Benedict took time at the start of his visit to Australia for World Youth Day to meet with sisters at the Blessed Mary MacKillop Memorial Chapel and spend a moment in prayer at Mary's tomb.
Miss Mary was born in Melbourne, which was then part of New South Wales.
Josephite sister Maria Casey is the postulator for the cause of canonisation of Mary MacKillop. She tells us more about the life of this extraordinarily determined woman.
Her father had been in a seminary in Rome for a number of years, but ill health and other problems forced him to return to Scotland. He was very, very well educated, and so he gave Mary a lot of her early education. Her mother came from the MacDonald clan in Roy Bridge area of Scotland, very strong, devout Catholics. When her mother was pregnant with Mary, one of the Franciscan fathers gave her a small relic of the Holy Cross, which was very significant because later in life Mary took the title Mary of the Cross and was known as Sister Mary of the Cross. Her childhood was a troubled one in the sense that her father was very idealistic and a wonderful man, but was not able to keep a job because his ideals impelled him to speak out. So he often lost his job and the means then of supporting his family. They moved frequently from place to place. So when Mary was very young, she had to give up whatever education she was having and go out to work to support the family. In her late teens, she went to Panola in South Australia to be a governess, again to earn some money to support her family. But she saw there that there was absolutely no education for the poor, and especially the Catholics, who were very discriminated against. She also saw the Aboriginal children in the area that nobody looked after. And in her spare time, she used to take care of a couple of these Aboriginal children. She wanted to become a religious, but when she looked around, at that time there were very few religious congregations that seemed to meet what her ideals were. So she was blessed in meeting this priest, Father Tennyson Woods, who also had an ideal of providing education for the isolated and the lonely. And when she founded her congregation, and it started in a stable at Panola, she had this vision that her sisters would not live in large houses, as most of the other congregations did by their rule. They would live in twos and threes, and they would go wherever the need was. And so to achieve that, she had what she called central government, that there would be a superior general, as it was called in those days, and that she would be responsible for placing the sisters. That was contrary to the way the things were done in those days, because the bishop had that power. And so that ideal, where she wanted to be free to move where the needs were, but also to have this central government, came into conflict with the bishops. Her local bishop at first was very supportive. He died and his successor was very supportive. And one of the bishops from Bathurst invited her to send some sisters. But when they got there, he decided that he wanted to change the rule that had some approbation so that he would be totally in charge. The sisters were given the opportunity to make a decision whether they wanted to stay under a changed rule or stay with Mary. One sister felt compelled to stay behind because some young women were beginning to join that particular group. So from that, a new congregation formed, the Sisters of St. Joseph of Perthful, and eventually from them, four other separate diocesan congregations where the bishop was. As time went on, they became what's called pontifical institutes, which gave them the kind of government that Mary had wanted in the first place.
But Mary's conflicts with local priests and bishops continued, and for a brief while she was even excommunicated, leaving many of her sisters to be looked after by the Jesuits and some Jewish and Protestant supporters. When the excommunication was lifted a few months later, Mary went to Rome to see Pope Pius IX and get a constitution for her order set down in writing. But not content to sit around and wait while this lengthy process took place, she travelled around Europe, learning more about how education was being most effectively used to lift people out of poverty in other countries. Back in Australia, she continued her pioneering work, and she died in 1909 as the Mother Superior of her Josephite sisters. Today, the order numbers around 900 sisters plus over 4,000 lay associates who assist in various aspects of the sisters' ministry. While education remains a strong focus of their work, the charism of Blessed Mary MacKillop continues in many other projects with the poorest and most marginalised people in Australia today. Sister Maria Casey again.
Mary also said that she should never see a need without trying to do something. So while the education was the main charism, it was to be free for those who couldn't afford it. For those who could, they paid a little bit. The sisters depended for their livelihood on the little bits of money that the people could give them, and for the rest they begged. Other poor people she did not neglect. She had a home for mothers who were abandoned, for orphan children. She also helped prostitutes and those that wanted to come out of jail and start a new life. So she had quite a big social work aspect to her work. But yes, her, in terms of charism, it was to live poorly as the poor lived, in houses like they lived in. So that as the congregation developed and some of the sisters went to mining towns, for instance, they lived in tents the same way as the miners. They moved when they moved. They went along, and a lot of our foundations were along railway lines so that the sisters could travel back and forth. They not only taught in the schools, but they visited every family, which was unheard of for sisters in those days. The apostolate with Aboriginal people was delayed. Mary had tried several times to get a foundation in Daly River in the Northern Territory area. Various circumstances prevented her from getting there, but in the 1960s, our sisters went there with a formal foundation, and it has spread now to several other centres, and the reception by the Aboriginal people has been marvellous. They say, you are our kind of people. And they recognise something of the respect that each of them have for the land and for the culture. They set up what they call two-way schools, that there was side by side with the sisters teaching, there were some Aboriginal women that they trained who would teach the Aboriginal culture and their way of life, so that they had the two side by side. And it has become a model for a part of the university that was developed, Notre Dame Australia. And it's established now in the Kimberley area very successfully, with the result that there are many Aboriginal teachers who train in their own way and can now go back to their communities. And so the education is doing very, very well.
My thanks there to Josephite Sister Maria Casey, postulator for the cause of canonisation of Sister Mary MacKillop. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.